This is Place Matters, a podcast at the intersection of race, place, and poverty, where we explore the belief that the path towards ending inequity and promoting prosperity is through the work of holistic neighborhood development. Welcome to Season 6, Voices from the Field, where we speak with historians, researchers, authors, and thought leaders whose work is shaping the field of place-based development. I'm Sean Duncan, the Director of Training and Consulting at Focused Community Strategies and the host for Place Matters. When we look at the income and opportunity disparities that exist between neighborhoods in our cities, it is common for people to point to actions taken in the past: redlining, contract sales, racial housing covenants, and the like. Though these practices were very real and created very real harm, talking about them leaves the impression that what we're dealing with today is simply the legacy of past actions. Unfortunately, this is not the case. Though we are dealing with the impact of past harms, we are also contending with present forces that are causing both racialized and class-based harm. The mechanisms of inequity that we are facing today may be much less explicit than they were in the pre-civil rights era, but they are just as entrenched and just as problematic. Joining me today to identify some of these present-day forces of inequity is Dr. Richard Collenberg, professorial lecturer at George Washington University's School of Public Policy and Public Administration. Author and editor of 18 books, Dr. Collenberg is an authority on housing segregation, teachers' unions, charter schools, community colleges, and labor organizing. Today, we are talking about his book, Excluded, which is an examination of how zoning laws are being used to promote opportunity for some and perpetuate disadvantage for others. Listen in as we discuss modern-day practices of exclusion and what we can do about it. Richard, thank you so much for making time to be on Place Matters podcast today. We appreciate you.
Absolutely. Glad to be on with you, Sean.
Good stuff. Well, I'm always curious, before we kind of get into your scholarship, your research, your work, like, what led you to do this at a personal level? What kind of put it on you in your life to want to invest your academics and professional life in this direction?
Yeah. Well, I'd say I've written about education inequality for years and years and years. And I probably came to that from my parents. I was raised in a socially conscious family that cared about inequality in society. And so in America, it seems like education is a way in. There's a sense that we don't have a European style democracy where we're going to have a really, really strong safety net. So education is the way for people to move up. And so for 30 years, I've been writing about education issues, and I kept bumping up against housing policy, and housing policy is school policy. So one of the big findings in education is that the biggest predictor of how well someone's going to do is academically is their, you know, the economic status of their family and the education level of the parents, you know, whether they can provide all sorts of advantages or maybe are struggling. But the second biggest predictor is the socioeconomic status of the classmates in a school. And this has basically been, you know, ignored by most policymakers. That is to say, students from low-income backgrounds can do amazing things if given the right environment. But we tend in America to, you know, segregate and pack low-income students into high-poverty neighborhoods. And we know that that makes a huge difference, that low-income students given a chance to go to, economically mixed schools are almost 2 years ahead.
Right.
Academically, of low-income students or in high-poverty schools. Mm. So anyways, I've been trying to use efforts kind of through the public school system to allow more choice. But then we come up against this reality that three-quarters of Americans send their kids to neighborhood public schools. Mm-hmm. That's the rule in the United States. And so that depends on where people can afford to live.
Yeah.
And so my new book, Excluded, talks about the architecture, the way that by design, mm-hmm. low-income people and people of modest means, working class people, are kept apart from more advantaged folks.
Yeah, and even though this isn't overtly about education, I love that statement that housing policy is education policy. I have two kids in high school that go to the local public school where we are, and the levels of inequality, not even just when we go play a private school, they play soccer. So so we're multiple games a week. They play on different teams. And so we're at schools all over the Atlanta metro area. And the level of inequality, again, not just public to private, but public to public, is fascinating. We left one game last year. My son was like, "Is this a private school?" I'm like, "No, son, this is not a private school." Though, but again, there's all these other housing policies that have led to these great inequities in the school systems that are not that far away. I mean, these are, yeah. I can meet somebody for coffee in less than 10 minutes in one of those school zones. It's just right down the road, and the level of inequality is pretty profound. And one of the things, obviously, that you dig into and Excluded is the idea of how single-family zoning, some people call it exclusionary zoning, how that perpetuates these inequalities in a lot of ways. But I think for a lot of people, single-family zoning is not only not a problem, it's not even something, it's not like a thing, right? Like it just seems so natural that to change it would be to like mess with what's normal or what's natural. But I mean, historically speaking, has like restrictive single family zoning been the way we've always developed our cities in the U.S., or is this something that we've added into the way we think about city or community design?
Yeah, it's developed over time. There's historically, we used to allow all sorts of housing in different communities. You'd see, row houses, you'd see apartments, and we didn't have this system where there were huge swaths of land where you could only build a detached single family home. It started in, there were really two waves. The first was in the early 20th century. I believe you're in Atlanta.
Is correct.
So Atlanta is one of the places where there was racial zoning. Mm-hmm. So if you were a black family, you could not move to a predominantly white area by law. I mean, this was built into the zoning regulations. Well, that was declared unconstitutional by the Supreme Court in 1917. Mm-hmm. So it's quickly, people got around that. White people got around that by suggesting, yes, anyone can live here of any race so long as they can afford a single family home, detached home. Oftentimes they throw in a minimum mm-hmm. acreage requirement to keep people out. And so racial zoning became economic zoning. And so that was the first wave. And then the second wave came in the 1970s when communities really doubled down on single family exclusionary zoning. And that was also had a suspicious relationship to passage of the 1968 Fair Housing Act, mm-hmm. which had made it illegal to discriminate based on race. And so that's the other time when we saw communities really put in more restrictive zoning. And you're absolutely right. We think of this as a natural thing. Yeah. It's kind of baked into the landscape. I live in a single family home. I have nothing against the concept of a single family home. But the problem is when entire neighborhoods say, we don't want any variation. Mm-hmm. And what that ends up translating into is less variation by income, by race. Mm-hmm. And we all end up in our own bubbles.
Yeah. And let's talk about some of the negative impacts of this. And so, first of all, think about affordability. I think for some, when they hear challenges of single family zoning, they only think what we're talking about is increasing multifamily for low income individuals. Now, certainly that would be an outcome if we change zoning laws. But you argue that the single family zoning makes things less affordable for everybody. It's not just low income. It's all incomes and life stages that that this level of single family zoning that's so exclusive, it makes things more expensive for all of us. So how is that the case, or why is that so?
Yeah. Well, there are a couple things going on. First of all, you know, single family exclusive zoning in certain expensive neighborhoods, that screens out middle class people, sometimes even upper middle class people. So so there's that mechanism. But the other piece of this is that when you reduce the supply of housing, the number of houses that can be built, that results in an increase in price for everyone. And that's, you know, that's by design, actually.
Yeah, supply demand, the basic principle of
economics. That's right. That's right. I mean, we saw this, you know, during COVID. Some of your listeners may remember the cost of used cars skyrocketed. Mm-hmm. And it was because there was a constraint on the supply of cars. And so people, you know, there was still demand for cars, but people, there were fewer available. Well, that exists in the housing community all the time because of government laws that say you cannot build the types of housing that people want, where you want, where they want it. We're going to restrict that, the number of units, and require these large, lot sizes. Mm-hmm. And so that's what drives up the prices. Just simple supply and demand.
Yeah. And I've seen the conversation shift for some folks where when their mental image is a large kind of government complex multifamily for 100% low income, like that does some of the conversation was like, no, your kids are in college right now. When they graduate, they won't be able to afford to move back into the neighborhood they grew up in. They won't be able to afford to be here, largely because of the supply demand thing with single family. And they go, oh, maybe there is something to this, that like we're all impacted by this, not just, you know, certain groups.
That's right. And that's why we've seen, that's why we've seen political movement on this question. Unfortunately, in this country, you know, when a problem only affects low income people or working class people, that does not get the attention of politicians. But mm-hmm. we've seen a wave of reform of these zoning laws, in part because people who went out, they got a college education, they have a job, they still can't afford a home when the younger people. So this is cuts across economic lines today.
Mm-hmm. And so there's the sheer affordability issue that single family zoning brings that affects all of us. But there are other negative impacts to our cities, to our personal well-being. So what are the other implications maybe we don't think about that aren't directly about housing or housing costs, that when we build our communities in a single family zoning way, what are the other negative implications for our life outcomes?
Yeah, well, I think it's bad on a number of levels. It's bad. It's bad for the environment. It's bad for the strength of our democracy. It's bad for education. So let me just explain each of those. In terms of the environment, we know that when people are in their automobiles for longer commutes, that contributes to greenhouse gases that change the climate. And people have to live somewhere. And so if they work in a urban area, they may not be able to afford any place other than on the very periphery of the metropolitan area, and because that's the housing is less expensive out there. And so they have these long commutes, which are bad for them because, you know, there are increased divorce rates, less time with kids. I mean, just that's not one that's difficult to explain. People get the bad commutes are bad for the commuters. Also bad for all of us because of the environment. It's also bad for our democracy because we're increasingly sorting ourselves by income. And that results today in there's a correlation with political beliefs. It used to be, of course, that a highly educated tended to be Republican. That's beginning to change now, and a lot of highly educated people are Democrats, but there's not interaction between people of different political beliefs the way there used to be. And it's a lot easier to demonize someone else or some other group, whether you're Republican or Democrat, if you don't, you know, have time that you spend as neighbors, and, you know, talking about your kids and talking about common interests. then it's, as you know, for me, most importantly, it's bad for educational opportunity. When we segregate by income, that really robs everyone of the opportunity to tap into the talents of all our children, and so lots of negative impacts of these policies.
And it's interesting when you're talking about the racial zoning. I mean, so for any of our listeners that are like me in Atlanta, you can find online pretty easily the racial zoning map of Atlanta. And then you can find, when we weren't allowed to do that, you can find the initial zoning map of Atlanta. It's the same map. They just changed it from white, black to one, two, this. They just changed letters and numbers around. It's the same map, right? And so what's interesting is that even though that was unconstitutional, and even though we've made all these reforms of the Fair Housing Act, the white, black home ownership rates are as far apart as they were in 1960. So thinking about just black advancement, black and brown communities, how, since it is not just illegal, but unconstitutional, right, to discriminate against a home buyer by race, then how in the world does single family zoning play into the fact that we're still, as the equity gap between white and black ownership is still as far apart as it was, you know, 60 years ago?
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you brought that point up. I have a whole chapter in my book about the way in which exclusionary zoning particularly hurts black Americans. Mm. So Richard Rothstein and Ta-Nehisi Coates and a number of other people have documented the terrible ways in which black people were robbed of wealth in this country, you know, obviously going back to slavery, but then more recently through our housing policies, you know, redlining and the racially restrictive covenants. So we did not invest in black home ownership. And that means today that there's an enormous wealth gap between black and white people. So, you know, the income gap is bad enough. Black people make about 60% of what white people make in terms of annual income. But then the net worth, you know, your ownership of assets is, you know, the gap is more like 10 to 1, you know, where black Americans have about 10% of the median net worth of white Americans. And so that plays into the single family zoning mechanism in this way. You need a sizable down payment to buy a single family home, more than you would for a smaller unit. So the impact on black people who historically are facing the legacy of all this terrible discrimination means that, but they're more likely, even when they make the same income as white people, more likely to be shut out of high opportunity neighborhoods and to be hurt and to be shut out from home ownership entirely.
And I think that's like one of the things I find so important about your book is not just the historical context preceding all this, which is, again, like Rothstein and others, just really important to know the history behind all of that. But I find that even amongst those who are aware of that history, the thinking is still somewhat, what we're dealing with is the legacy of that history. Like we're just cleaning up a mess that's currently not being made anymore. But what's so compelling and important about your book is like, no, we're still actively making that mess, right? And so even for the people who see those images of large signs outside of neighborhoods of this is a whites only community, you know, everybody else stay out. So we see these like highly racialized racist signs and like we're disgusted by them as we should be, right? But I think one of the really important parts of your book is say, hey, those signs aren't visible. Those walls aren't literal as far as physically visible, but it's just as strong. There's one particular quote that I think is really crucial in this. And from your book, you say, wealthy white people, for the most part, are not violent in their exclusionary tactics and don't hurl stones or bottles. Again, we're thinking about these violent images of the past. What they do hurl are obscure zoning ordinances that keep people out just the same. The exclusion doesn't take place in widely televised violent confrontations on the streets. It happens in little-known confines of zoning or planning board meetings. And so, like, Yeah, we would today protest violent outbursts to keep certain people, certain races out of a certain neighborhood. It's like, well, but we're not protesting these planning board meetings. We're not protesting the zoning codes. But your point is they're having the exact same effect as the hyper-racialized laws of the past.
That's right. Yeah, it's comforting for us to think that, you know, these racist policies are in a disgraceful past, but they're being perpetuated every day when we allow exclusionary zoning laws to stand. And my belief is not that most people are actively trying to exclude. I think most people, I certainly wasn't fully aware of the effects of single family exclusionary zoning. But I think people are becoming more aware now. And so it becomes incumbent on all of us to try to take action to make change.
Hey guys, just wanted to take a quick break from this conversation to make an invitation. If you are feeling challenged by these conversations and are wondering how to address these realities in your own neighborhood, please reach out to us. Place-based work is too hard to go at it alone. So whether it's some one-on-one coaching or us walking with you through our two-year cohort called City Shapers, we're here for you. Please reach out to us today at fcsministries.org.
You talk about one of the, I think, not unique and alone, but it is definitely a defining characteristic, I think, of the American mindset when it comes to zoning laws, single family zoning and otherwise, is this idea of meritocratic elitism is one of the phrases that you bring up. And that really appeals to the American mindset as kind of justification for why we should have zoning laws that are constructed as they are. So what is that? What does that term mean? And why is it a myth? Like, why should we maybe question that way of thinking about how we come to have what we do in our neighborhoods?
Right. Yeah. Well, to be clear, I believe in merit.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that jobs should be filled by people who are qualified, and that, that meritocracy is better than nepotism or, you know, other forms of deciding who gets ahead. But the problem is that there's social science to document that the individuals who, quote unquote, succeed in the meritocracy, in the words of one philosopher, you know, they inhale too deeply of their success, and they discount the role of luck, all sorts of types of luck in deciding who's going to succeed, you know, the luck of being born into a family that's going to support you, the luck of being, being able to be in a certain neighborhood, go to strong schools. Mm. None of that's earned. That's just happenstance. And, you know, obviously some, you know, much of what people do is, you know, they're free agents. They deserve some of what happens in their lives, but not much of it is beyond our control. And yet people who think, well, I've succeeded, I deserve an exclusive neighborhood, also kind of by necessity believe that those who've not done as well, are somehow lesser than them. And should in some ways be kept away and kept segregated, economically segregated, racially segregated away from them. So I think that's the pernicious downside of meritocracy.
Yeah, and I was fascinated by even just looking at the numbers of how much subsidy from the government goes into creating single family suburban communities or neighborhoods, that's the people who live there aren't paying the full price for all that. Like, that's subsidized by the government's investment. And that number is significantly larger than the subsidies the government provides for what we would call low income housing. Right. So even it's like, no, you're not, you're getting a bigger subsidy for your exclusive neighborhood than low-income individuals are getting for their, quote, government housing. So it'd be fascinating to start calling all of this government housing or government projects.
That's right. I have a friend who speaks about housing issues in different communities, and he'll say at the beginning, you know, raise your hand if you live in subsidized housing. And no one does. Almost all of you do. You know, through the mortgage tax deduction, through deductions for property taxes. I mean, there are a variety of ways. They've been cut back in recent years, but they still exist for a lot of folks. And so so we are subsidizing, as you say, much more for middle and upper middle class people than we are for low income people.
Yeah. And so I come to your research and your book, like not overtly because it's about housing, even though FCS does do housing work. Our primary lens is about neighborhoods, and we care about healthy neighborhoods, which gets us into the housing work. But we're not trying to solve for housing. We're trying to solve for healthy, equitable neighborhoods. And so in your book, you talk about that as well. That what we're talking about here is not just housing inequality. We're talking about neighborhood inequality and neighborhood segregation. So why would it be important to think about this, not just in terms of who has access to what kind of housing, but in terms of what kind of neighborhoods our kids are growing up in?
Yeah, well, I think that we all lose out when neighborhoods are economically and racially segregated. And most of the social science research focuses on the way that that low-income and working class people lose out. And that's much of what drives my interest in this work. And so Raj Chetty at Harvard has done a lot of extensive work to show that the wages of children who move to higher opportunity neighborhoods before age 13 are much, much higher. You know, over a lifetime, they'll make $300,000 more. Same individual. They have opportunities of going to a lower poverty neighborhood. I think less recognized is that middle class and upper middle class people are losing out too. You know, people of means travel. They travel the world because they want to experience new foods and new types of music and interact with people who have different cultures, different languages. And, you know, we have all of that in the United States. We are a nation of immigrants. People are coming from all across the world to live here. And yet we don't learn from one another. I mean, the upper middle class people who think they're, you know, doing something good for their kids by living in this segregated neighborhood, economically segregated neighborhood, are robbing their kids of the chance to interact with people of different backgrounds. And, you know, there's lots of research that suggests diversity makes us smarter. And that you have the when there is a diverse school or in a diverse neighborhood, people are introduced to different ways of thinking, to novel ideas, and that's something that could benefit everyone. So I think it runs both ways. Everyone's losing out when those neighborhoods are segregated.
Yeah, man, I'm so with you on that. And I think probably you know, one of the controversial things that I've had to weigh into in time is that idea of what school you're choosing for your kids, right? It's a very personal decision. Nobody deserves to be poked in the eye for doing what they're trying to the best for their kids, right? But I do remember, so my kids have been in the local public school system from kindergarten all the way up. I have a freshman and a senior right now. And I've had a number of friends along the way in the same community opt out of the local school system. All the local schools are Title I, so it comes with stigmas that aren't true and challenges that are true, right? And, you know, and some of the arguments have been, many of them legitimate, not all of them, that, you know, about this idea of opportunity, right? That getting, not choosing these schools and putting them in another is more opportunities for the kids. And at least for my family, like what we're filtering is like, there's an opportunity loss when you leave the richness of what these schools are about, because they're not all low income. It's mixed income. It's maybe majority low, but it's mixed race, mixed religion, mixed income. Like I wouldn't trade that dynamic for the opportunities that may come more in a homogenous environment, right? And I think the ability to say this isn't just about diversifying our housing so that low-income people have a better shot, which will be true, right? But it's also about, again, it's about all of us, I think, that there's something better for us socially, economically, politically, when we kind of opt in with each other on this.
I think that's very well said. I mean, everyone loses out when we have that segregation.
Mm. And I think one of the things I really loved about your book is that you came for all of us. So whatever political seat you're sitting in, if you read Excluded, he's coming for you, right? So because none of us are not implicated by the system that we're in. And so I think whether you're red, blue, purple, independent, confused, conservative, liberal, kind of wherever you are, your group is either pushing back against zoning changes or fighting to preserve them. And so I want people to read this so they can kind of go like argument by argument. What are the, depending upon the political seat you're in, what are the traditional arguments and how do we begin to maybe think about it differently? But if you could maybe just choose one more conservative pushback and one more liberal pushback against changing zoning, and how do you encounter those conversations?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So one thing for me as someone who's left of center that was uncomfortable to realize in doing research for the book is that the worst forms of exclusionary zoning are actually in politically liberal parts of the country and then even within states in more liberal areas. And so my conservative friends delight in that finding, as you can imagine. And I think that you know, one of the exciting things is that there are real possibilities for bipartisan reform. I'm with the Progressive Policy Institute, which, as its name suggests, is left of center. We recently had an event with the American Enterprise Institute, which is a conservative organization, and we both came to the same conclusion that the exclusionary zoning is bad policy. Now, I was coming at it more from a social justice standpoint. It's bad for opportunity, bad for the environment, bad for civil rights. But the conservatives see exclusionary zoning as a form of government regulation that is interfering with property rights. So there ought to be a lot of overlap. Having said that, to get to your question, there are conservative and liberal arguments that are made against change. As well. So there are factions within each political party that are also opposed to exclusionary zoning. So on the right, you would see that, frankly, represented by Donald Trump. I mean, during the 2020 campaign, went after Joe Biden and on this issue of single family zoning and said that, he was trying to tweet to what he called suburban housewives of America. Mm-hmm. That the Democrats are going to ruin, abolish the suburbs was a phrase that he used. So, and they're going to reduce your property values, bring crime. I mean, it was playing on all sorts of stereotypes that the research suggests is over. These fears are overblown. Mm-hmm. So that's on the right. On the left, it's interesting. I mean, the argument that I hear sometimes is that reform to the zoning laws doesn't do enough.
Okay, yep.
And they'll say, well, we want more, they claim. Mm-hmm. We want more affordable housing. So we want more government-subsidized housing. So there's a policy, which some of your listeners may know, called inclusionary zoning, where when a builder develops a certain number of units, he or she sets aside a portion of those units for low-income families. Some liberals have said, well, it's only 15% that's set aside in this proposal. We think it should be 50 or 60% set aside for low-income families. And it sounds like they're very virtuous, welcoming more low-income families in, but they know that the math won't work, that the developer will actually never build that unit. because there's, you know, it won't be profitable for them if they set aside too large a share. Mm. So that's kind of an insidious way in which some on the left have come out against reform as well.
Yeah, and I appreciate that, because again, and just the nature of the work that we do, I think more often people are going to have more of a bent towards social justice because we're involved in historically Black neighborhoods that have been redlined, excluded, have been harmed, and we're working to build equity in these places. And so we obviously attract people who have that inclination. And I think there's something about the stories that you unfold about it. It's one thing to put like Black Lives Matter in your front yard, but like, are you willing to live next door? Right. Are you willing for your community to include those Black lives? Right. Are you willing for your neighborhood? Like you can care about quote the poor, you can care about these social issues, but like if it's not out your front door or amongst you in your neighborhood or going to school with your kids, like it does begin to kind of call into question, like, are these ideals, right, that we want to donate towards or vote for, or is it a way of life we want to live into, day in and day out in our actual neighborhoods? So I appreciate the challenge that you bring, that this is, we're all a part of this, like whether we, and that's, I think that's the important part of a lot of your work, is that it doesn't have to be overtly racist. It might even be accidentally racist in its outcomes, but if it's having disproportionate harmful effect on minorities, we have to pay attention that this is no different than the overt redlining maps, that this is still what we're getting into today. One of the things you're advocating for in the book, and I've been digging in due to your research and encouragement and sharing with others as well, is this idea of an economic Fair Housing Act, that we had the Fair Housing Act passed in 68. We've over the years added more groups to be included into that Fair Housing Act that weren't included at first. But you're saying it's still not done. It's still not complete because we're still allowed to be very exclusive. So what is this Economic Fair Housing Act that you're interested in? What is it that's missing that it's addressing, and how can we get behind it?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think race is a big part of what's going on, but part of it is class discrimination as well. Wow. And so we see in places like Prince George's County, Maryland, which is a predominantly Black community, economic divisions within the Black community. And so mm-hmm. wealthier Black people wanting to erect walls to keep lower income Black people out. Mm-hmm. Same is true among whites in mm-hmm. places like La Crosse, Wisconsin. You saw wealthier whites trying to exclude lower income whites. And so it's in addition to the race problem, for which we do have some tools, there's a class problem. Mm-hmm. One of the political scientists I quote is Omar Wasso, who talks about in a community where he was living in Princeton, New Jersey, said, people do have the Black Lives Matter. They say we welcome our Muslim neighbors so long as they're millionaires. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So there's this class dynamic to it. And the Economic Fair Housing Act is meant to take that head on and say that just as it is is illegal currently to have government laws that discriminate based on race, we should have a comparable set of tools to go after and make it illegal to discriminate based on class. Let me be clear by that, because people get confused. The market, the free market in housing, by definition, discriminates based on class. If you don't have the money, mm-hmm. you can't buy a home. I'm not talking about messing with that. What I'm talking about is the idea that government laws will exclude people based on their income or economic status through the zoning laws. And so under the Fair Housing Act, which deals with race primarily, and a number of other categories, as you point out, it's illegal to adopt policies that will disproportionately, government policies that will disproportionately hurt protected racial groups. Mm-hmm. I'm suggesting to add into that concept that if you disproportionately hurt working class people, low income people, that you'd have to have a strong justification for doing so. Not that it's impossible to justify. You just have to provide a really good reason why this neighborhood needs half acre lots. I mean, what's really going on there?
Yeah.
They can't provide a good reason, then those government laws should fall.
And you talk about just that we're allowed to do source of income discrimination. Like it'd be illegal to say, because you're of XYZ race, you can't rent this apartment. You'd be in trouble. That's illegal. You can't do that. But I can say, because of your source of income, I am allowed to discriminate against you. So what is that source of income discrimination, and why is that problematic?
Yeah. Well, the major source of subsidized housing for people of modest means is the Housing Choice Voucher Program. Mm-hmm. And there are landlords who will say, if you have a Housing Choice Voucher, we're not taking you on as a tenant. So it's source of income, meaning that part of the reason that the family can afford this particular unit is that their family income through wages and other sources is supplemented by a government housing choice voucher. And so that is, it's routine in the United States to discriminate based on that source of income and screen out. Sometimes they'll even say it publicly, no vouchers. As we did in the old days, no black people, no tax apply. And so that's what's going on. There are a number of states that have on their own said this isn't right. And they've enacted statutes making it illegal to discriminate based on source of income. But there's no federal law to do that. And even in the states where there are good laws to protect against source of income discrimination, when testers go in, they find out the discrimination remains rampant because these laws aren't enforced enough. So it's a huge, huge problem.
And I really appreciated, the statements you make in the book about the fact that we've learned, and I'd say most all, and hopefully everybody, but maybe not everybody's there yet. We all agree that, discriminating by race in your neighborhood is shameful. It's wrong. Like whether it's legal or not, it's morally, ethically, it's just wrong. It's shameful. Right. But if there's a neighbor that discriminates by class, it's actually seen as desirable. It's promoted, right? Like if I were shopping for a house and somebody walked up to me in the neighborhood and said, hey, you would love to live here. Only white people like you are allowed to live here. I mean, I'd be in my car out of there fast and be like, who do I need to call? Call the news, But I mean, it can be on billboards or it can be in my mailbox to say, hey, this neighborhood, we want you, it's exclusive. And we're not allowing certain people into this neighborhood. And so class discrimination is actually, it's celebrated. It's seen as desirable. And that you're summoning us as a culture, as a society, say like, we need to have the same level of dis-ease about that as we would any other kind of level of exclusion that might exist.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think racism is somewhat worse than snobbery.
Yeah.
So I would always say, given our history of the way violence has been used against black people, I think there is a distinction. Having said that, the racist and the snob are cut from the same cloth. They're basically saying a certain group of people is so degraded that they should be, in essence, quarantined, kept away from entire neighborhoods, kept out of areas, and that violates all sorts of, all the major religions would say that that's not the way we ought to be treating people, and I think it's fundamentally wrong to have the belief in the first place. That racial groups or economic groups are somehow beneath others, but worse, to put the imprimatur of the law to say we're going to pass laws to zone people out, I just think is really deeply, deeply troubling. So cultural changes take a long time. I mean, changes around race have taken forever. But finally, we're beginning to reach a better place there. And I hope that we can all similarly recognize that the income or class discrimination is wrong, too.
Well, thank you just not just for being on today, which is a huge gift that you'd be willing to join us in this, but just your work and what you're advocating for, education to housing to neighborhood equality. I've been excited to grow and be blessed and challenged by your work, and I've enjoyed sharing with others and look forward to more people just knowing about what you're doing and what you're up to, and just the hope that we can get behind this, that we can get behind which is going to be good for all of us. Like this should be bipartisan. We should all be able to see that like our communities are better by this. This doesn't just have to be because you want someone who's hurting to stop hurting. Like this is actually like, if you care about happy, healthy, vibrant places, this is something we can get behind to see a more democratic and healthy place and neighborhood. So thank you just so much for your work. I appreciate you a lot, Richard.
Well, thank you, Sean. And I have to say, I do a lot of these conversations, and I've really enjoyed this one. You awesome. Clearly are deeply invested in this work and this thinking, and so I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
If you have been intrigued by this conversation and want to dig in deeper, I encourage you to read Excluded, How Snob Zoning, NIMBYism, and Class Bias Build the Walls That We Do Not See, wherever books are sold. Place Matters is produced by Focused Community Strategies, whose mission it is to partner with under-resourced neighborhoods to provide innovative and holistic development that produces flourishing communities and God's shalom. Place Matters is hosted by FCS's training and consulting team. If you would like to inquire about our training and consulting services, please reach out to us via our website or find us on LinkedIn and social media. This information can be found in the show notes. If you would like to watch these episodes, the videos can be found on our YouTube channel. And if you like this episode, please share it on social media. Your support means a lot to us. The show was edited by Tim Rhodes with music by Eric North. Special thanks to David Park, Becca Klein, and Rose Silva at FCS for their work in organizing and recording these sessions. We would like to say thanks to our partner, Lilly Endowment, Inc., whose Thriving Congregations grant has made this podcast possible.